Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, there's a lot of talk in this country about the federal deficit, but if we hope to meet the moral test of our times, if we hope to eradicate child poverty or AIDS or joblessness or homelessness, then I think that we're going to have to talk more about the empathy deficit, the ability to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes, to see the world through somebody else's eyes.
The empathy deficit. That was then Illinois Senator Barack Obama back in 2006 expounding the need for empathy, which he maintained throughout his presidency as a guiding virtue for his politics, he says. My next guest agrees that empathy, the ability to understand and share the feelings of another, is way more than a greeting card sentiment. It's a tool which can create radical social change or even a revolution of human relationships. Sound intimidating? Luckily, he is also a teacher of empathy, and he's going to show us all what we can do to be a little more empathetic and also put it in a larger global context. So with us now is Roman Kresnarek, cultural thinker and founding faculty member of the School of Life in the UK. He's also founder of the first Empathy Museum and author now of the book Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. Thanks very much for coming back on WNYC. Hi.
I'm delighted to be here again, Brian.
And you write in your book that in America, empathy rates have declined by 50% over the past 40 years. How do you measure empathy?
Empathy is really difficult to measure, that's for sure. And there was a famous study, the one you quote there from the University of Michigan, showing that empathy levels have dropped. In fact, the steepest decline has been in the last 10 years. So how do you measure it? Well, you can measure it badly. And one way of doing that is asking people, how empathic are they? How likely are they to step into somebody else's shoes when they see them suffering? But there are better tests. The one I like is called the Reading the Mind in the Eyes test, developed at Cambridge University in England, where people are shown a set of eyes and with four words describing the feelings on or the emotion that person might be expressing, like joy, sadness, or anger, or something like that. And you have to match the word to what you see in their eyes. That's a really good empathy test. Most people are actually quite good at it because most of us have this ability to step into our shoes, wired into our brains. We each have a 10-section empathy circuit as part of who we are.
You write, since World War II, the dominant message has been to pursue our own personal desires and self-interest based on the assumption that we are, in essence, selfish creatures and that the good life lies in consumer pleasures and material wealth. So what's the flip side to that?
The flip side is that we have been developing as human beings for 2 million years to cooperate naturally. Of course, we're partly selfish creatures, and that's been exacerbated by consumer capitalism and all those forces. But even little kids have this empathy as part of them. I've got twins, and when they're about 1.5 years old, a boy and a girl, before their natural empathy developed, you get a situation where my son might be crying and his sister would try and comfort him with her favorite toy dog, which wasn't much use to him, a kind gesture. But fast forward until about a year, that when they were 2.5, and when my son was crying, his sister would try and comfort him with his favorite toy cat. Right now, that's the cognitive leap of empathy, imagining what is it like to be another person. And it makes all the difference to relationships, whether it's in, you know, at home in the living room or in the war room as well. So I think we overdosed on the idea that we are selfish creatures and we need to rebalance and recognize that we are homo empathicus as much as homo self-centricus.
Can you put this in global or national terms too, like when leaders and people or entire nations through history showed lack of empathy, leading to Holocaust, war, famine, and the list goes on? Is it worth having those conversations in this context?
Absolutely, because I mean, I'm someone who actually, I used to be a political science professor, and I gave that up because I recognized that you don't just change societies through, you know, elections and party politics and new laws and so on. You change it from the grassroots, from people coming to understand each other. And this really matters for big global issues. And I'm inspired by extraordinary empathy building projects. For example, in Israel and Palestine, there's an organization called the Parents Circle that runs projects. One of them was called the Hello Peace telephone line. Any Israeli could phone a free phone telephone number on billboards around the country, and they were put through to a Palestinian stranger who they could talk to about anything at all for up to half an hour. Palestinians could call Israelis in the same way. In its first 5 years of operation, over 1 million calls were made on the Hello Peace telephone line. It was this amazing grassroots empathy-building experiment. And we can think, how can we apply that in all sorts of situations, getting climate change activists to talk to climate change skeptics, getting people on the divide of, you know, institutionalized police racism talking to people in communities that are suffering from it, using Skype and all sorts of other technologies which we have easily at hand. We can start bridging social divides using empathy as a really smart tool.
Are there historic examples on the other side? You know, we can talk about nations and empires with lacks of empathy. How about historic examples of mass, national or international empathetic flowering? Are there any?
There are a lot of them all the way through history. We're always taught about the moments of conflict or empathic collapse like the Holocaust that you mentioned. But peppered through history are moments of extraordinary collective empathy expansion. I mean, just think of in the United States in the earlier 20th century, the great social documentary photographer Lewis Hine, a New Yorker I seem to remember, went out and took photographs of children who were working in the cotton fields, who were working in glass factories and in textile mills. Nobody believed this kind of child labor was going on until Lewis Hine took the photographs, and there was an empathic response to what people saw on the faces of these children. And out of that came a whole load of legislation which started trying to tackle the child labor issue in the United States. And that was a moment of empathic expansion. And there are many others like that. Without empathy, I think we're emotionally tone deaf as individuals, but we're also emotionally tone deaf as a society.
You're right. Empathy is now acknowledged as an essential ingredient of human well-being and helps create the human relationships that give our lives meaning. But you also acknowledge that curiosity about strangers doesn't come naturally to humans. So how do you reconcile that, aversion to strangers and desire to be empathetic, if those are both actually cooked into our collective DNA?
It's a tricky thing. I mean, I'm someone who's not naturally curious by nature, but I remember when I first started listening to the radio shows of the great Chicago radio host Studs Terkel and recognized that actually it was curiosity which not only made him one of the great interviewers of people from janitors to senators, but it was something that helped him lead a more interesting life himself. It allowed him to step into other people's shoes and be empathic, but also expand his own, you know, intellectual and other kind of life. And I think we've all got to be engaged in that struggle to try and expand that curiosity, which is beaten out of us as we get older. We've all got it as kids, of course. My children are incredibly curious and will go up to, you know, anybody on the street and start chatting to them. And we live in urban environments where talking to strangers is often something that we are told not to do, especially children, we should hold back from. But I think that a good empathic prescription is to have a conversation with a stranger at least once a week and get beyond superficial talk. Talk about the stuff that matters in life, like love and death and religion. And this is exactly, of course, what happened in New York City after 9/11. The reports of people having extraordinary conversations with strangers, Muslims talking to Hasidic Jews and so on, that created an understanding, a recognition that these people are just the same as I am. We're all human beings in this together. And that's how you start building more empathic societies.
My guest is Roman Krasnarek, author of the book Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. And as you hear, we're talking about empathy, not just on the personal level, but on the big socioeconomic and sociopolitical level. 212-433-WNYC. We have just a few minutes for a couple of phone calls. But if anybody wants to get in with a thought or a question for Roman Krasnarek, 212-433-9692. And I've been saying you're the founder of the first Empathy Museum. There's such a thing? I can walk into a building and it's called the Empathy Museum?
It's not a building. It's better than that. Our first exhibit, which opened in London in September, was a giant shoebox on the banks of the River Thames. And it's now traveling the world, going to Australia. I hope to bring it to the United States. And what happens is you walk inside the shoebox and one of our empathy shoe shop assistants will measure your foot and give you a pair of shoes belonging to someone from a totally different walk of life. It could be someone who's been in prison for 14 years. It could be a sewage worker. It could be a bearded drag queen with size 12 stilettos. And you're given their shoes and you're given an audio of them talking about their life, a narrative of who they are, and you can literally walk a mile in their shoes. So we're taking that that idea that we all know, to don't criticize another person till you've walked a mile in their shoes, and making it real. And they're the kind of exhibits that the Empathy Museum is taking globally.
And do you have something called an empathy library also?
Yeah, we've got an empathy library online where you can find books and films all on the theme of stepping into other people's shoes, anything from To Kill a Mockingbird to films like My Left Foot. But we've also founded what are called human libraries, where you go along and instead of borrowing a book, you borrow a person for conversation. So you might borrow a Quaker pacifist or a young Muslim teenager or a bored, burnt-out Wall Street banker, and you talk to them. And of course, it's all about overcoming prejudices and assumptions that we all have built into us. And it's conversation, I think, which is one of the most powerful ways of blowing apart our prejudices. Because let's face it, we're so often wrong about people. We judge them by what they look like and what they sound like. And conversation is the empathic elixir which can break down those barriers.
Let me get one call in here at least. Ted in Sunnyside, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ted.
Well, hey, Brian. It's great to be on the air with you. And it's such an important conversation. And I wanted to share the words of my daughter, who unfortunately we lost at age 11 10 years ago. But she wrote this, and I'm just reading her words. I've been thinking about a new idea. If humans could have one superpower, what would it be? I finally decided it would be the power to see things from another's perspective. I think if the arsonist in California discussed yesterday could yell, frighten and upset their victims where they wouldn't have done it, the power wouldn't be there if all you had to see was why your microwave wasn't working. It would kick in when you guys got an F on your science report and you're about to yell at your teacher, you're going to kill someone because you think they killed your father. And then the power would kick in and you would see that your teacher thought that you hadn't been thorough or that the person hadn't killed your father. You could be in a war and hear the enemy's mind praying to make it home safe. There wouldn't be as many wars.
Wow. Well, I'm so sorry for your loss, especially of someone who seems like she was so morally advanced at such a young age. Ted, I'm sure this is hard for you, so thank you for sharing that with us.
Well, I'm so happy to share Hallie's words, and her life goes on in so many ways, and she was the happiest person I ever met, and so much of it was because she empathized with everybody, with every person she met, with animals, with plants. She was just full of love, and the first words we found from her after she died were, "People, be nice to each other. Love, Hallie." So I'm just thrilled and appreciate giving a chance to share her words. And please keep up the good work that you're doing, both of you.
Thank you very much, Ted. Well, I can't top that. So as we come to the end of our segment, can you, other than to say goodbye?
I'll just say that Ted's daughter hit the nail on the head and has a knowledge that I wish politicians had, that if they could step into the minds of enemies, people on the other side of dividing walls, create that understanding between rich and poor, black and white, across those divides, I think we'd be in a very different social space. We don't have to think that empathy is all a soft skill, a kind of a mushy feel-good factor. It actually is powerful. That's what history tells us. That's what Ted's daughter is telling us. And I think we all ought to be trying to create a revolution of human relationships. And empathy is a pretty good way to do that.
Roman Kresnarek, founding faculty member of the School of Life in the UK, founder of the first Empathy Museum and Empathy Library, and author of a new book, Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And speaking of empathy, of all the candidates for president to have a viral video moment at this time, it's Chris Christie, and it's not one of his famous confrontation tapes. We will play some extended excerpts coming up of Christie's passionate and, yes, compassionate speech and put it in the context of presidential politics and public health and explain why it's getting millions of views on YouTube and praise from all points on the political spectrum. Stay with us.